The explosion on an oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico and the oil slick heading toward the shore got us thinking about looking into offshore drilling as a topic on Please Explain. It's possible that the Obama administration's recent proposal to open more of the Atlantic coastline, the eastern Gulf of Mexico, and the north coast of Alaska to oil and natural gas drilling may be derailed. This morning, White House senior advisor David Axelrod said that the plan to expand offshore drilling is on hold until there's been an adequate review of what's happened in the Gulf. Joining us now to explain how oil is discovered, how wells are drilled, and safety and environmental concerns are Paul Bommer, a senior lecturer in the Department of Petroleum and Geosystems Engineering at the University of Texas in Austin, and oil historian Tyler Priest, professor and director of global studies in the Bauer College of Business at the University of Houston. Welcome to our show.
Thank you very much, Leonard.
Paul, I know you aren't a geologist, but can you explain how oil is discovered under the seafloor?
Yes, you are going to ask me to practice without a license here. I can see that right away. I can say that geoscientists, which would be geologists and geophysicists, try to map what is possibly available under the earth by running seismic surveys. So, if you will, it would be like taking a vertical slice out of the earth. It's sort of like an MRI of the earth. And what it allows you to see are the various folds and faults and places where oil and gas might accumulate. Now, that doesn't mean they're there, but at least they could be a home for an oil reservoir. So the oil and gas, if it exists at all in these places, is actually held in the pore space of the rock.
Do we have any idea of how the amount of oil underwater compares with what we get on land?
That's a pretty good question, actually, and I was brought up to believe in the oil business that you don't really know what's down there until you drill a well. I think history has proved me that that's a true statement. Now, the oil and gas that has been discovered offshore in the places we know it exists, I believe it has been a substantial contribution to the production of the nation. But I'm afraid you have me at a bit of a loss. I can't give you a number on that.
Tyler, do you know?
The Minerals Management Service, which is the agency in the Department of Interior that leases federal territory on the so-called federal outer continental shelf, I think has an estimate of somewhere in the range of 30 to 60 billion barrels of undiscovered on the entire federal OCS, it's called.
But that's just
an estimation, and you know, estimations can be very wrong. I should say that the deep water, which is, you know, the Transocean rig was drilling in 5,000 feet of water. And that's sort of the area that the companies are really interested in these days. The reason why it's such an intense focus area is not so much because of the size of the fields, but because of the productivity of the wells in those fields. If you take a well on the continental shelf in the shallower water areas of the Gulf, a good one may produce 1,000, 1,500, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 barrels a day. But when you get out into the deep water into these so-called turbidite sandstone reservoirs, they have a much higher rate of productivity, 10, 20, 30, and upwards to 40,000 barrels a day. So they're very productive.
Paul, is the platform created first before the drilling begins?
Well, that depends on how deep the water is. If you're drilling in water that isn't too deep, then you can actually build a platform if you wish in advance. The platform, the old platforms actually had steel legs that went all the way to the ocean floor.
But when you're talking about 5,000 feet, you're talking about quite a distance.
Yeah, that's right. So when you get out into the deeper water, the platform, as you call it, becomes a floating vessel. So that's what was out here in this water, was actually a ship, if you will. It doesn't look much like a ship, but it's floating. And it's connected to the wellhead, which in this case people call a blowout preventer. And the blowout preventer sits on the ocean floor and is connected to steel pipe that is placed and cemented in the wellbore during the process of drilling it deeper. The blowout preventers are connected back to the vessel by a rather large diameter segmented piece of pipe people call the marine riser. So the marine riser is an extension of the well, if you will, coming back from the blowout preventers to the vessel.
Aren't there, Tyler, also undersea systems? Are these relatively new?
I'm sorry, they just had me off the line, so I didn't hear the previous conversation.
Well, we were talking about the ways that the various kinds of platforms, the old ones, which were kind of just permanent on steel legs, and now the new floating ones when you go into deeper water.
Yeah. The question is when, how far back this industry goes?
Well, I will ask you that question. How far back does the industry go?
Well, the petroleum industry had found innovative ways to drill and develop oil fields beneath the waters of shallow lakes and bays and even on trestles out into the ocean going back to the turn of the century. But it wasn't until really about 1938 was the first freestanding platform in open water, and that was off Cameron, Louisiana. And then the industry really got going in the late 1940s and has really not stopped. The key innovation, when you talk about production platforms, these are up until the deep water era were fixed on the seabed.
And the image in my mind is that they're sitting there and then the oil is coming up into the rig.
Mm-hmm.
And it's similar to what we see on land with the derricks and the water and the oil's just spurting out.
It, you know, it goes into separator facilities and eventually into processing facilities and then into the pipelines or in some cases into tankers. But most of it, you know, it's transported back to land on pipelines. The key thing about, you know, the Transocean vessel was what is called a semi-submersible drilling vessel. And the industry really achieved, it's a mobile drilling unit. That is the generic name used to describe mobile drilling vessels. And the industry really achieved this mobility in the 1950s. First with, something called a submersible vessel, and then jack-up drilling rigs that have these legs that jack the platform out of the water. And and then they could be jacked up again, and the vessel could move to a new location. But the real innovation was this semi-submersible, and that was the brainchild of a Shell Oil naval architect and marine engineer by the name of Bruce Collop. And the maiden voyage for that one was in 1962, and after Shell demonstrated that you could drill in 300 feet of water without, touching ground except for the anchors that were attached to the mooring lines, the industry really moved into ever deeper waters. Exploratory drilling is done by these mobile drilling vessels. Production is on fixed platforms until you get out to 1,000 feet of water, a little bit more. The deepest fixed platform is Shell's Bullwinkle at about 1,300 feet of water. But beyond that, the practical cost and design limitations prevent you from using fixed platforms.
Do single rigs drill and pump from multiple wells?
Well, this particular rig. Oh, I'm sorry, Tyler.
Yeah, no,
if you don't
go
mind.
Ahead. No, go ahead. Yeah,
I didn't mean to walk on you there.
No, this is a good one for you.
But the mobile drilling unit drills this well, and when the well is finished, what they would do when it was successful, they would take the blowout preventers off and they would install a subsea production wellhead to take its place. And then you can run all kinds of seafloor pipelines, and we're even inventing some subsea separation facilities. But ultimately, the oil and the gas has got to come to shore. So one way to do it is to lay a pipeline on the ocean floor. If you're not too far away from the continental shelf, you might be able to tie into an existing production platform with the flow from the well. Otherwise, you may need to bring an umbilical up to the surface And you can tie into a floating production and storage and offloading vessel that ultimately would probably shuttle the oil to shore in a tanker. So that's sort of the way the industry does this now.
My guess,
and multiple wells can be brought to a common production site.
We're talking about offshore drilling with Paul Baumer, who is senior lecturer in the Department of Petroleum and Geosystems Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin, and Tyler Priest, professor and director of global studies in the Bauer College of Business at the University of Houston. He's an oil historian. This is Please Explain on WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. How long does it usually take to drill a well underwater? And, and what happens to exploratory wells that don't have anything? Are they filled in?
Yes, they're plugged and abandoned. A well typically is plugged by setting a variety of different concrete plugs in the well proper, and then the wellhead, where the blowout preventers used to be, will be capped off permanently, and that site then is considered officially abandoned.
And does it take weeks, months to drill a well?
That, of course, is a strict function of water depth and the depth of the well. But, you know, what BP's talking about, just for the replacement well here that might be necessary to ultimately kill the blowout, it might take 2 or 3 months.
Tyler, how is permission granted for offshore drilling?
Well, it's a long process. And, you know, you have the state waters, Louisiana. The state of Louisiana has jurisdiction out to 3 miles, and beyond 3 miles, it's federal land. Texas, it has it out to 10.5 miles, and this goes back to prior Spanish claims, as does the west coast of Florida. But the Minerals Management Service will hold a lease sale auction, and the territory is mapped out on a grid into blocks, about 5,760 square acres. And the oil companies will first do a geophysical survey, a seismic survey. You have to get a permit to do that and to decide which prospects they're interested in. And then they go to the lease sale, and they bid on those blocks. They offer bids. And they're called signature bonuses. It's basically a price bid to obtain the lease. And if they are the highest bidder, they get the lease. And then they have to file an exploration plan and go through a series of permits and so forth. And then and if they discover oil, they submit a development and production plan, and that goes through a series of approvals, and then they establish production.
The rig in the Gulf was leased by BP from Transocean.
Yes.
What kind of company is Transocean? Do they just supply the rig and then tell BP you can do whatever you want with it?
Well, Transocean is the world's largest offshore drilling contractor. You know, there are different segments of this industry. You have the operating companies. That's BP and Shell and Chevron and ExxonMobil. They're the oil companies who, you know, obtain the leases, but they don't own their own drilling vessels. That's a whole other segment of the industry. They hire those vessels often on a day rate. They pay a day rate, and these vessels specialize in drilling the wells. And Transocean was a culmination of multiple mergers among many different offshore drilling companies. You know, the ancestors of Transocean include Global Marine and Sedco, which was founded in 1947 by former Texas Governor Bill Clements, the offshore company, Santa Fe Drilling. All these companies really were hit on hard times in the late 1980s and early 1990s when you had the collapse in oil prices, and companies lost their appetite for exploring in deep water, and these companies had all these drilling vessels, and so there was a period of consolidation, and Transocean is, you know, the largest in the world. I think it has 17 drilling vessels with more than 300 rig years of deep water experience.
Now, Tyler, why was offshore drilling banned in 1981? Was that due to environmental concerns?
You mean banned on other coastlines?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, it's, you know, this beginning in the 80s, Congress began enacting these bills with prohibitions on leasing activities. And, you know, it really sort of goes back to the Santa Barbara blowout in 1969. That's really catalyzed the environmental movement, and there were some lease sales held off the Pacific coast, but sort of the regulatory environment closed ranks on it. There was some drilling in, you know, off Delaware and in the Atlantic, but you know, there was opposition built to a point where in 1990, the first president, George Bush, issued an executive withdrawal, taking these areas out of you know, consideration, and Clinton extended those restrictions, and George W. Bush in 2008 removed the withdrawal, and Congress in sort of annual appropriations also imposed moratoriums on these areas, but they allowed that process to lapse, and so that technically opened up these areas to consideration again.
Well, we're going to be going to a break in just a moment, but I want to ask Paul something that may sound a bit naive. With the awareness that this sort of thing can happen, shouldn't the drillers have developed all sorts of safeguards to prevent this sort of thing? Shouldn't there be valves in sequence so that you can stop it before it gets out of hand, as we've seen in this explosion?
Well, I think the industry believed that it had those fail-safes in place. I think one change that may come, and perhaps very appropriately so from this, is all of the backup mechanisms that were in place were installed to make the blowout preventer function. I'm going to tell it to close, and it will. It appears that the flaw here is that perhaps all of those backup systems were indeed screaming at the blowout preventer to shut, and it just didn't. So perhaps the sea change that may be coming is we're not going to have just one blowout preventer. Perhaps we have two, perhaps we have three, and they're all independent units. We're not going to rely on the one unit to function regardless of how many times we tell it to close.
Was there a blowout preventer in Santa Barbara before that?
Oh, yes.
That accident in 1969?
Oh, yes.
There was also a major spill in the Bay of Campeche on the Mexican side of the Gulf.
That was another blowout.
So I guess these are accidents just waiting to happen.
Well, of course, the industry would not view it quite that way. I guess we would have to agree that they do happen. They've been tolerably rare, but I believe that this one will usher in a reevaluation of the way the offshore business is conducted. And I think we'd have to agree that review is perhaps necessary at this point.
We are going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll take listener calls at 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. You go to our website, WNYC.org, and follow the instructions and go to our show page. Please do not send me any email because I'm not looking at that email. My guests are Paul Baumer, who's a senior lecturer in the Department of Petroleum and Geosystems Engineering at the University of Texas at Austin, and Tyler Priest, professor and director of Global Studies in the Bauer College of Business at the University of Houston. We're talking about offshore drilling on today's Please Explain. 212-433-9692. We're talking about offshore drilling on today's Please Explain with Tyler Priest of the Bauer College of Business at the University of Houston, and Paul Baumer, who is at the University of Texas at Austin. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Before we get to those calls, at the time of the accident in the Gulf last week, federal officials had already been working on new rules for offshore drilling. Do you know what kind of new rules were being called for? And would they have prevented an accident of this sort?
I really don't know what the new regulations might have been.
I'm not certain about that either. I do know, though, that the real concern for the MMS regulatory program was focusing more on protecting facilities during hurricanes. And they were particularly concerned with the offshore drilling vessels and their mooring systems during the hurricanes. Because what happened when you had Rita and Katrina come through, that these exploratory mobile drilling units would have to be moored, but they would get buffeted around in these violent seas, and their anchors would sometimes rip up the pipelines and they would be damaged. So, again, I'm not sure if that was the real focus of new regulations, but I know that that was a concern of theirs.
Well, are there? Does oil tend to show up in places where there are weather issues, like places that are too cold, or places like the Gulf of Mexico where hurricanes are a normal occurrence?
Well, you know, the old adage is oil is where you find it. The deep water is a very prospective area for the industry in the Gulf of Mexico, in West Africa, off Brazil. The industry is looking very closely at the Arctic. These are extreme environments.
Yeah, the North Sea is a great example of a very hostile operating environment that has produced a lot of oil and gas to the benefit of the countries thereby.
And those oil rigs have not had any spills?
The biggest accident that I can recall in the North Sea was actually a production accident. It was the Piper Alpha disaster that I'm sure Tyler can speak to better than I can. But that was a major fire with severe loss of life. In fact, I can't remember, Tyler, did they lose Piper Alpha? Did they lose the platform?
Well, I think it eventually had to be scrapped. This disaster reminds me of three historical analogies. The first is the Piper Alpha. And at the very beginning, when you heard that 11 people were missing and now presumed dead and 17 injured, Piper Alpha was a production Occidental Petroleum production platform where 167 people perished. And my thought was, thank goodness they were able to evacuate the 100 other people on the Transocean. I mean, that was very big.
Well, fire should be a major concern, right?
Yes, yes. And then the other analogy, it was the worst blowout in history in the offshore industry was in Mexico's Bay of Campeche in 1979. This was the Ixtoc 1. Pemex was the operator, and Sedco, forerunner to Transocean, was drilling it. It was a semi-submersible drilling in about 150 feet of water. But that well blew out for 9 months. Hmm. And, I think official estimates were 7,500 to 10,000 barrels a day, other estimates ranging up to 30,000 barrels a day for 9 months. But they were fortunate in that most of that oil sort of drifted into the deep Gulf and didn't destroy very sensitive ecosystems. Some of it came up onto about 140 miles of beach on South Padre Island, but it was a terrible disaster. And then, of course, the comparisons are now being drawn to the Exxon Valdez. And if this well blows at 5,000 barrels a day for 50 days, that will equal the Exxon Valdez spill.
Well, I remember during the after the invasion of Kuwait, or after Kuwait was then taken back, they had to cap all the oil wells that had been uncapped. But I would imagine it's a lot easier to do that on land than it would be underwater.
No question about it.
So how do you do it? I mean, you send people down there. with masks and oxygen tanks? And
No. It's too deep. 5,000 feet of water is too deep. They send remote operated vehicles down, and they tried to, they deployed a few of them to try to activate the blowout preventer, from what I understood, and they failed in doing that. They've talked about building these domes to put down where the leaks are and try to actually produce the oil. That was a solution attempted at the Ixtoc well. It was called Operation Sombrero. They developed a funnel to try to produce oil. It didn't work very well. But ultimately, the way they're going to get this well under control or kill it is to drill these directional relief wells.
And what they're talking about is actually burning off the oil that's out there. Is that the best approach?
That'd be a great approach if it worked, if we could keep it from reaching land. Sadly, I don't think you're going to be able to ignite all of this. I think the horse is long out of the barn now, and this oil that's coming ashore, it's in tendrils. It's not easy to gather up. In fact, it's probably ungatherable really at this point.
Let's take some calls. We have a caller from Union City. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, I have a question. I'd like to know how many oil wells there are in the Gulf of Mexico. I had heard it's 37,000 plus.
That's about right. That's pretty close. There's 39,000 wells. They're between 3,500 and 4,000 platforms. Around 1,000 of those have personnel on them. And then, you've got tens of thousands of miles of pipelines.
There was a caller who hung up who was going to ask about whether earthquakes are a concern. Does oil tend to occur in areas that are earthquake-prone?
I'll leave that to Paul.
Well, I think in the Gulf of Mexico, it's not a seismically overactive area right now. Although, for example, the small country of Trinidad down by Venezuela, which really isn't all that far away, is on what I believe they call the Caribbean Plate. That is a fairly active area, and they have a significant oil and gas industry offshore Trinidad. Of course, Venezuela is well known for its oil production. So, I don't think we can rule out the possibility of seismic events. It's just that in the Gulf, that doesn't seem to be a very active area.
And that, of course, is the concern in California, where the design criteria are much different. They have to take into account earthquakes, and people worry, of course, legitimately and understandably along the coast of California about what an earthquake would do to those platforms that are there. They still have active platforms still there that were installed long ago, but the people in California don't want to see any more.
Carol from Westchester, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. You were just talking about burning the oil on the surface of the water as being, sort of the best of all possible solutions. But I'm just wondering, when that's happening, what's happening under the surface of the water? Is there kind of a toxic particulate matter that's drifting down to the seafloor, or what does that do to the environment immediately under the burn? Thanks so much. I'll take the answer off the air.
Well, most of the oil, when you can get it to burn, the combustion is on the surface where the water is. Now, certainly you heat the water up some. There's no doubt about that. But most of the combustion products are going to the atmosphere. Now, that's not ideal, but that's what's happening. And whatever doesn't burn would be a heavy tar-like component that might actually have enough seawater in it to where it would be neutral buoyancy. It might sink. If it ever did come to shore, it's likely that we would have a better chance of scooping that up. So I think that's what probably happens when you burn this stuff.
Thank you so much for your call. We have a number of listeners who seem to have suggestions for what can be done. Brian asks, why isn't it possible for workers to simply collapse the well in some way? And another listener asks, Shelley in West Orange, is it possible to send tankers with vacuum pipes to suction up the oil that's gushing up to the surface?
Well, the problem with the suction idea, and believe me, they've tried that. They've got vessels out there with, for lack of a better word, vacuum cleaners. The oil disperses. Anybody who's ever had a little droplet of oil on your driveway knows that a little bit of oil disperses on water rapidly and in a very thin film. So it's very difficult to scoop it all up. And if it were possible, they'd be doing it, believe me, because we've tried with lots of different spills to do it this way.
And, there was a time when people were talking about finding bacteria that would eat the oil.
And that's true. There are bacteria that eat the oil, but they don't do it overnight. It's a slow process, and I know that that happens on shore. In fact, that is a remediation option for spills on shore. I am not sure what kind of bacteria that you could put in the ocean water. There may be one. But again, the problem we're having right now is one of time. Time is not our ally here. Collapsing the well, if you thought you could do that and be 100% successful, I think we'd be after it. I think we'd be down there with a submarine trying to shoot a torpedo at the blowout preventer. But what the other concern is, what if I blow this blowout preventer up or hit it with the mythical big hammer and I just knock it off? Is this a restriction that's actually helping staunch a bit of the flow? So there's the unknown possibility that I might make this thing worse.
And I've also heard that the engineers are concerned about the integrity of the wellbore, that it might collapse around, and that could be catastrophic.
We have go ahead.
No, please, after you.
I was just going to take another call, but you should finish this thought.
Well, the well itself, the oil, we mustn't forget the oil is coming from 12,000 feet beneath the ocean floor. So it has a long pathway before it gets to the surface, and there is some restriction to flow depending on what kind of pipe is in the well. The pathway may be rather small in places. So that restriction to flow doesn't go away. Now, if we lose the wellbore entirely, then chances are, in my mind, there is the possibility that this well will do what they call in the industry sanding up or bridging. Most reservoirs don't like to flow wide open, particularly these deep water wells, because we find that the sands are unconsolidated. So this thing may make some reservoir material with it. And if we're lucky, if Mother Nature is going to give us a miracle, she might just sand this well up.
We have virtually no time, but Camille from South Orange, can you ask the question very quickly?
Yes. I'm originally from New Orleans, and I want to know what the oil companies are doing to help rebuild the wetlands that their drilling technology helped to erode over the years.
Yeah, well, we have to almost end it there. Are they doing anything?
Good question. She's right. There has been some erosion, and I don't know what the remediation process is. Tyler, do you have anything on that?
It's a long, complicated story. Coastal remediation. And
our thanks to both of you, Tyler Priest and Paul Bommer, for participating in today's Please Explain Look at Offshore Drilling. It's been a real pleasure.
You're welcome.
Thank you very much.